At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you suppose happens when banks get creative? Well, three things usually. One, they make a lot of money. Two, consumers usually wind up paying. And three, Congress gets curious. Banks and the commodity markets. Coming up on the broadcast today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 23rd of July. Good as always to have you with us. And hey, what do you know? But the Wall Street banks were in the spotlight again. Nothing exotic this time, no collateralized debt obligations or credit default swaps. That is very 2008. No, we're talking far more mundane things like metals and oils and electricity. You would be well within your rights right about now to ask what exactly those have to do with banking, which is kinda the point. Today, the Senate Banking Committee spent some time trying to figure out whether, say, Goldman Sachs ought to be allowed to own, say, aluminum warehouses or ships that transport oil. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
It may sound obscure, but commodity storage could be affecting you right now in the price of gas fueling your car and electricity powering your home, or the can of beer cooling you off.
It has cost MillerCoors tens of millions of dollars in excess premiums over the past several years and billions to the entire industry with no end in sight.
That's Tim Weiner of MillerCoors testifying on the Hill. He says other companies like Coca-Cola share his frustration at a system where banks hold raw materials like aluminum. Some of that cost winds up in the price tag of things we buy every single day.
Banks are doing this to make money. So when they're making money, somebody's got to pay the price.
Campbell Harvey is a Duke finance professor. This is not about banks trading commodities through some complex Enron-style deals. They actually have warehouses stuffed with metal and tankers full of oil. Critics say banks are choking supply, which jacks up prices.
When the banks get injected in the middle, it makes sense that the cost increases.
University of Houston professor Craig Perong doesn't have a problem with what banks are doing. The commodities expert says storing raw materials is partly just banks hedging their bets.
Storage facilities in commodities tend to be one of those kinds of assets that can actually perform well during the down part of an economic cycle, and that's when storage facilities make their money.
Banks say they're just doing with commodities what they do with money. Keep it safe for the owners until they need it. And they say they're not manipulating markets, just playing by the rules. But with powerful industries lining up against them and regulators taking a fresh look, the rules may change. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Other than maybe getting into college, the part of higher education that teenagers and their parents have long worried most about is the rising cost of that education and how much debt it's going to mean. But a study out today suggests families are rethinking the way they pay for college and that schools might be responding. Sarah McCammon reports.
If you think paying for college is scary, try two tuition bills at once. That's coming soon for 46-year-old Tim Wilson of Colfax, Iowa.
I have a senior to be at Simpson College, and I have a freshman to be that will be attending Simpson College.
The sticker price for the small liberal arts college is around $39,000 a year for tuition, room, and board. Wilson works in sales, and his wife is a teacher's associate. They've been putting aside money for college every month since the kids were small. Between that and financial aid, Wilson says they've covered about 90% of their oldest son's costs.
And we fell a little bit short of my second son, just because of the markets the way they were over the last few years with the savings account. And so we're kind of scrambling.
Many parents are struggling to keep up. A new report by student loan provider Sallie Mae finds they're contributing about 35% less than just a few years ago, from $8,700 a year in 2010 to $5,700 now. Sallie Mae's Sarah Dusich says parents who could used to pull out all the stops to pay for college.
Yeah, they really reached into every single pocket and basically broke the piggy bank.
But after the recession, Dusich says that's changing.
I think the shift is that parents and students are approaching paying for college with a greater cost consciousness than they've ever had.
Like relying more heavily on students working, looking for less expensive degree options, or, horror of horrors, living at home. The Sallie Mae report also finds that scholarships and tuition discounts are covering more of the costs than parents' spending. Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of Edvisors.com.
The colleges are reacting to supply and demand, and there are some colleges that have had trouble filling their classes.
But he points out, even with a big scholarship, private school students still tend to pay more than their state school counterparts. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Today, as every day, supply and demand was in full effect on Wall Street. Two down, one up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's some news of Spanish language radio to pass on today. The nationally syndicated show hosted by Eddie Sotelo, known to his fans as El Piolín, has been canceled. Broadcaster Univision had nothing to say about why, nor has El Piolín himself. The show was a mix of music and skits, as well as news and newsmakers.
We're going to start, Mr. President. I'm going to give you the option. You know, which topic would you like me to begin with?
We can talk about anything you want, Piolín.
I'm going to give you options. Multiple choice. Are you ready?
I am.
A, immigration reform. B, immigration reform. C, immigration reform. Or D, all of the above.
I think I'll take D, all of the above.
Any morning host, you got to figure, that can book the president of the United States is doing something right, but not enough right, perhaps. Gustavo Arellano is the editor of the OC Weekly down in Orange County, California. Welcome to the broadcast.
Gracias for having me.
Give us a sense, would you, of how big this guy is or possibly was?
El Piolín was a combination of NPR and Howard Stern in Spanish for the Spanish language masses. I mean, this is a guy who, at his height, appeared in hundreds of radio stations across the United States with his morning show. Monday through Friday would be on the air for 5 hours. I mean, this guy was funny. This guy had on, you know, big names like Ted Kennedy, President Obama. But most importantly, he was his audience. He was a guy who came into this country illegally, pulled himself up by the bootstraps to find untold success in the United States, and he told his audience, if I could do this, you can too, and it's also our responsibility to do that in this country.
And now he's out on his ear. What gives?
I personally think Univision, they were starting to get upset that his ratings were dropping. Unfortunately, even though you might have this great big media presence, if there's new people who are coming into the mix, sometimes the audience does want to try out the new phenomenon.
Talk to me for a second about Univision. They are most known, I think, listeners will recognize them, for their role in television. Clearly, they're in radio as well. Where are they in the Spanish-speaking media landscape?
Univision is the Spanish language media landscape. Of course, they started off with their television stations, but in the past 15 years, they've gone into the radio business, they've gone into the CD business, they've gone into the website business. They really have everything. They're the Standard Oil of Spanish language media, and there really is no competition. Telemundo, which is number two, It's like ranking Ford in its heyday to, oh, I don't know, Schwinn bicycles. It's just not a conversation.
So what's Univision doing then?
They want to be the top of the top, and to have a rival go after them, for them it's just unacceptable. So their current strategy, at least with El Piolín's home radio station, 101.9 FM in Los Angeles, is to have it as mostly music, which is something that a lot of radio stations on English language are doing, like all music, all the time, have no radio personalities whatsoever, because all radio stations, their ratings are dropping because of Pandora, Spotify, And Spanish language radio, it's no exception.
There's an economic part of this, right? It's all about ratings, and Univision is a for-profit company and all that. But LPLN specifically, there was a political genesis to his you know, relevance, wasn't there?
This is where I find it very surprising that Univision would just drop him ceremoniously. In the 2006 amnesty marches, the largest marches in United States history, it was El Piolín who really galvanized not just the Latino community, but his rivals as well. There was like this sort of Yalta conference that El Piolín had on the air, 11 of his rivals from across the United States. And he said, all right, all of us, we have our own radio stations. We all have our own audiences, but it's our responsibility as these powerful voices to get our audiences out on the street. So for Univision to just, you know, give them the boot, to me, it's inexplicable.
You pointed out in your blog post on this either last night or this morning, there's a little personal element to this for you as well.
Well, yeah, of course. Full disclosure, if it wasn't for El Piolín, I wouldn't have my Ask a Mexican column, because my editor at the time, he saw a billboard of El Piolín with a Viking helmet. He didn't know what on earth this Mexican was doing with a Viking helmet, so he went to me and said, maybe you should start answering gringos' questions about Mexicans, and the rest, as they say, is historia.
And here we are. Gustavo Arellano is the editor of the OC Weekly. He also writes the column Ask a Mexican. Gustavo, thanks very much for your time.
Gracias.
Taco Bell, I'm going to guess, isn't the first thing you'd think of were I to say kids menu. And you know what? That is just fine with the fast food chain, which says it's dumping its small fry menu and the little plastic toys that go with it. The company apparently has bigger kids in mind, as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Who even knew Taco Bell had a kids menu, given that it's only about 2% of the company's $7 billion in sales last year? Not a lot of people. Bob Golden is an analyst at Technomics.
Taco Bell's target audience is millennial males who really are not coming to a restaurant with children.
And Golden says those teenage and 20-something guys aren't exactly health conscious. They want tasty, cheap food and a lot of it. Recently, Taco Bell introduced a taco in a shell made out of Cool Ranch Doritos.
And it's the last thing you'd ever tell your kids. But admit it, deep down, everyone has their favorite.
Michael Schaefer is a food and beverage analyst at Euromonitor International. He says with concerns about childhood obesity, Taco Bell would need to start serving healthier options to grow its kids' meals business.
If you're primarily marketing to people in their 20s, do you really also want to be promoting that you can get apple slices or vitamin D milk?
There's also signs that the kids' meals business overall is losing steam. Bonnie Riggs is an analyst at the NPD Group.
Back in 2008, we ordered 1.3 billion kids' meals at fast food restaurants.
That number is off by 2 million. Riggs says healthier foods are making kids' meals more expensive for parents. And kids are over it. They want more choice. Riggs says that could mean more fast food chains drop kids' meals too. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up, why we may just be over the whole summer blockbuster movie thing.
I think we are finally maybe getting fat on these high-calorie, high-cholesterol summer movies. We sort of are reaching for the less fattening version.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 22 points today, a 10%, finished at 15,567. The NASDAQ deleted 21 points, 0.6%. 35.79 there. The S&P 500 fell 3 points, 0.2%, wrapped up at 16.92. United Technologies lifted 3% today after the manufacturer of elevators and air conditioners raised its yearly forecast. Travelers, the company that insures other companies, saw its profits rise 85% last quarter, but its stock price still crumbled 3.75% today. Rival AIG gave back 1.8%. Netflix unplugged nearly 4.5%. The streaming service didn't add as many new subscribers as expected. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.51%, the number there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for June. Congress's Joint Economic Committee is scheduled to discuss America's crumbling infrastructure and how to fix it. And it's National Drive-Thru Day, but you may not have waited to celebrate that. I won't tell anyone. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
Thank you for visiting Marketplace. Would you like fries with that?
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are things out there, totally innovative things, like the iPhone or the Prius, maybe, that seem to catch on really, really quickly. There are, however, many others, many others, that don't catch on, even though they're useful or even essential, and they can take decades to become the norm. In the medical profession, that can mean the difference between life and death. Atul Gawande is a surgeon and a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, where his latest piece is titled Slow Ideas. It's all about why some ideas go viral and some don't. Dr. Gawande, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
This is, it seems to me, the $64 bajillion question, right? How you get those innovations that aren't catching on and you really spread them and make them go viral.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to think about why some move fast and some don't. I contrasted the discovery of anesthesia, which was a fast idea. It spread worldwide within weeks of its discovery in the 19th century. But around the same time, antiseptics were a slow idea. It took more than a generation for surgeons to accept the idea of washing hands. And what you had to do was literally a pain. Antiseptic solution for washing hands was carbolic acid.
Which is no fun.
No fun at all.
You're a guy who's made a study of this. I mean, you've written a book about how to change people's procedures, the Checklist Manifesto, your most recent book. I mean, this is a professional and personal interest of yours. And yet I thought it was interesting that buried way deep in this article is I think, the key line to this whole thing. People talking to people is still how the world's standards change.
Yeah. You know, we are, especially in this era of the iPhone and Twitter, enamored of technological solutions that spread as effortlessly as ether did. We want these frictionless solutions to all the major difficulties of the world, whether it's hunger, healthcare, poverty. But the reality is that when you're changing norms, technology and incentive programs are just not enough.
Take it down another level. You spent some time with labor nurses, child labor nurses in India, and watching them do their thing.
We have had this global problem. This is an example. Childbirth kills upwards of 6 million babies per year and 300,000 pregnant mothers. The steps to save all of those lives, especially in poor countries, have been known for almost a century. And a lot of it doesn't even require technology. I talk about the idea, for instance, that just skin-to-skin warming of the mom to the baby saves babies' lives, cuts mortality rates of premature babies by a third. And we think, well, how do you get people to do that? And we think, well, ad campaigns and incentives. It hasn't worked. But when you go face-to-face, understand what they're doing, why they don't do it, they change.
Not to bring in another discipline here, but how much of this is just straight-ahead behavioral economics? You know, incentives matter. People act in their own self-interest, all those things.
Well, the fascinating thing is behavioral economics is also showing us some of the limitations of the economic side of it.
Yeah.
So incentives are valuable. They help get people to try sometimes an idea, but they don't necessarily change the norms. To actually produce the change, people have observed over and over again that you have to see someone you know and trust actually do it themselves. And so when we look around at how we change healthcare, for example, the key for innovators is going to be providing clinicians with simple ways to change what they do next week and show them how and create the trust to take that risk of making a change.
Atul Gawande is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a professor at the Harvard University School of Public Health. Dr. Gawande, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on, Kai.
The Tour de France wrapped up this past weekend. British cyclist Chris Froome wound up in the legendary yellow jersey, and he apparently intends to keep it. No sooner was he off the podium than Froome said, and this is a quote, "This yellow jersey will stand the test of time." Time and drug tests, one assumes he meant. Doping scandals or not, the Tour has always attracted diehard cycling fans. Tour organizers are increasingly keen, though, to attract the interest of more casual viewers. And to do that, the business model that cycling follows may have to change. Christopher Wirth explains.
The Tour de France averages over 40 million viewers a day over 3 weeks. But Scott O'Raw, host of a pro cycling podcast for Eurosport, says even just being a casual cycling fan is a lot different from being a fan of, say, baseball, where if you're a Yankees fan,
you know, you would follow the Yankees and they would be the Yankees forever and a day.
And you'd have a strong emotional attachment to the team. But in cycling, teams are named after the companies that give them millions of dollars in sponsorships. As a result, pro cyclists are as plastered with ads as a NASCAR race car. And it leaves fans rooting for distinctly unemotional lineups, like teams,
Radio Shack,
and
Europcar,
the car rental company. And when a business decides to stop sponsoring a team, O'Raw says that's really when a cycling squad's troubles begin.
If the sponsorship changes, the name of the team changes. And I totally disagree with that, because if you're a casual viewer, you come in and you watch, you know, the Tour in July, and you think, I really like that team that's called blah, blah, blah. The next year, the sponsor could change, and you show up unaware that that business decision has been made, and you think, where's my team?
Leaving you, the casual cycling fan, confused and with no one to root for. Take the team that was named after the Dutch lender Rabobank for the past 17 years. I reached the team's manager, Richard Pluha, following his riders in the Tour de France by car in the Alps.
I think we should find a place to park because we are now in a gorge.
He says last year, Rabobank withdrew its sponsorship over doping concerns.
So suddenly we find ourselves without a sponsor and without a name.
So the team called itself Team Blanco, as in blank slate, until the American electronics company Belkin stepped in just a few weeks ago.
And so that's why we have three names in less than a year time.
And too many name changes like that are a problem for any team that wants to build a stable cohort of fans. Back in the 90s, Pluha's squad was known as Word Perfect, not exactly a winning legacy. He says the group will now try to turn Blanco into a moniker that sticks with the team, no matter who the sponsor is. Joel Seymour Hyde of the sports marketing firm Octagon says such a move could initially cost teams in sponsorship dollars.
But obviously the ultimate long-term goal would be a stronger and more engaged fan base, which you can then leverage in other ways.
Like team merchandise and loyalty programs that may be even more valuable to sponsors. Or if cycling teams don't want to upset the people writing the checks too much, former Tour cyclist Jonathan Botters has another idea.
What I'd like to see is if each team could come up with a color, a pattern, something that defines that team permanently.
For example, Botters now manages the cycling team Garmin Sharp, which he says always wears Argyle.
It allows people to understand, okay, this is the Argyle team. No matter what sponsors they have, these guys wear Argyle.
But without a name, even the seductive crosshatch of Argyle may not be enough to create a cycling team that fans can actually fall in love with. In Paris, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
This has been a long summer of big movies gone bust. Pacific Rim, Lone Ranger, White House Down. What gives? We're hoping Wesley Morris knows. He writes about movies for Grantland. Wesley, good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kai. What's happening?
Not much, except this. I have to tell you, I saw Pacific Rim the other night. I kind of liked it.
It's very likable.
Yeah.
It's a very enjoyable movie, you know, if you're going with it.
Right, that's exactly it. You have to go with it. The problem, clearly, is that not enough people this summer are going with it to Hollywood's liking. You got the Lone Ranger, you got all these things that are just, you know, bumming it at the box office.
Well, I think it's a tough thing. I mean, it's very obvious what's going on, I think, which is that I think audiences are kind of, like, enormous movie fatigued.
Yeah.
I think that every week now, I mean, this has been true for many summers, but I think it is finally catching up with us. Like, I think we are finally maybe getting fat on, like, these high-calorie, high-cholesterol summer movies. And we sort of are reaching for the, like, less fattening version of a big summer movie, which is how The Conjuring basically winds up being your number one box office hit this weekend.
Is that a scary movie, by the way? Because if that's a scary movie, I'm not going to see it.
Then you shouldn't go.
Okay.
And horror movies, you know, we should say, have always been popular, but it's rare that a horror movie opens in the middle of summer, and it's rare that it makes more money than movies like much more largely budgeted and much more heavily marketed than, say, the unfortunately titled, truly disastrous, very bad RIPD.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
And so at some point, I think once you're told that this is an enormous movie, because now audiences know how much these movies cost to make.
Yeah.
Now they know that, like, a studio has a lot riding on this movie. And I just think that the way in which we receive the information on these movies now completely warps our experience in some ways.
Let me ask you then, though, why box office is still up in North America this year so far?
Because we need something to do. And it's like it's what we do. We go to the movies in the summer. And that's sort of the way it's always been. I just think at some point there was enough to distinguish the summer movies from each other that there was a reason to go week in and week out, or a couple times a month. And now I think people are like, well, I've already seen Star Trek Into Darkness. I don't need to see Pacific Rim. Or like, you know, last summer or a couple summers ago, I saw Transformers 3 and didn't need to see Pacific Rim because it looks like the same movie. Even though, you know, they're very different. I think from a marketing standpoint, it's hard to make that case to an audience that is sort of wiped out on these movies.
Yeah.
And so if you see an ad for a movie with Lily Taylor floating in a chair and, you know, like people going, making clapping sounds and saying, you know, the ghost is right behind
you.
Yeah,
no, I'm not going to that movie, man. Are you kidding me?
Well,
no.
I think, did I just scare you, Kai?
Yeah, I don't do those movies. Wesley Morris covers movies for Grantland. Thanks a bunch, man.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that things are not always as they seem. The National Security Agency, for just one example, the all-knowing phone logging, email collecting NSA, you get the drift. Except for this, Justin Elliott, he's a reporter at ProPublica, filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the agency last week, trying to get some emails for a story he's working on, to which he got this response. There is no central method to search an email at this time with the way our records are set up, unfortunately, which kind of makes the NSA sound like a lot of other companies. I don't know. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM today. The Dow Industrials climbed 22 points, a 10%, finished at 15,567. The NASDAQ deleted 21 points, a 0.5%, 3579. The S&P 500 down 3 points, 0.2%, up at 1692, the S&P did. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. All right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.